Finally, we're going to listen to John Mohawk. He's with the American Studies program at the State University of New York at Buffalo, and he's Seneca from Western New York. He's Haudenosaunee, which is the Iroquois Confederacy, the Six Nations, and he was at Ganasadage during the Oka crisis. Sorry, I can never understand why people get Oka and Ganasadage confused. An observer delegate, he went to the 1987 land rights negotiations between the Nicaraguan government and the indigenous Miskito people, and is a member of several boards of directors, including the Indian Law Resource Fund, which is based in Washington, D.C., and is an advocate, of course, for native rights in the United States.
Some of you might have remembered me from long, long ago when I ran a publication that made about half of its information sharing about Latin America, and followed many of the struggles that took place in Latin America, and in fact, indigenous struggles around the world. So for a few minutes, I want to share with you kind of some of the things I came to understand about those struggles, and let you kind of contextualize them in the form of the information that you have about this one. I first heard the term low-intensity warfare in relationship to the struggles in the Philippines. It was something that occurred under the regime in World Bank leadership of Robert McNamara, who some of us will remember was a player in the Vietnam War. The theory of low-intensity warfare is that policies are put into place which cause enough hunger and misery that there's some resistance, even military resistance, by the people who are being oppressed. But it's kept that low intensity because whenever the misery becomes too high, you might have wide-scale rebellions like you're seeing happening right now in Indonesia. And while wide-scale rebellions aren't the point is to maintain as high a level, it's like a governor on a tractor, to maintain as high a level of misery as possible while not quite igniting wide-scale rebellion. So the theory here is that what drives the policy is a level of acceptable planned hunger, which I think is kind of an interesting political way to do things. The second thing I'd like to propose to you is that we, all the people in English-speaking world, are ourselves engaged in a struggle to understand how the world is changing and how it's changing for us and how it's changing for people far away from us, how it's changing for those of us who live in great urban centers in the center of Western population places where there's a fairly high level of what we think of as prosperity, and how it's changing for peoples on the great margins of the world's economy. So let us for a moment think about the two huge movements. And by movement, I mean something that's going on in the world which is driven by more than logic or rational thought. The two movements are NAFTA and GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, and the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now, these are two highly ideologically driven things. They're not driven by numbers. They're driven by ideology as much as numbers. And I want to get to that in just a minute. Let me get to that in just a minute while I shift your attention. Think about those trade agreements for a minute. And let me shift your attention to the history of the 20th century for a moment. This is the bloodiest century in the history of mankind. We've had more horrifying events take place in this century than at any other time in the history of the world. Most of these events, by the way, took place in the full purview of Western civilization. Western civilization played a role in most of them. Even the ones that took place in non-Western cultures in Asia were actually sparked by, motivated by, and driven by ideologies that rose out of the West. And by that, I mean the Khmer Rouge thing in Cambodia had a lot of Westernization attached to it. But let's go and think for a moment of the 20th century. What is it that sparks these events? which give human beings permission to do the most horrible things imaginable to other human beings. How can this happen? And essentially, that's what we're looking at, the potential for something like that to happen in Chiapas, much as that potential was realized in the late 1970s in Guatemala. How is it that people like you and me, who went to school, who grew up in communities, who went to church, who are considering themselves fully civilized human beings, how can people like that load up guns and go walking into a village and kill little kids and babies, shoot unarmed women, shoot old people? How can that happen? How could German people do that? How could they walk into those villages in Eastern Europe in 1942 and massacre little children and old people like they did? How could anybody do that? How can that happen? How can we understand that which gives people in their minds a permission to do that which is absolutely unthinkable, to create visions of horror greater than anything ever created by Hollywood in its most horrific films that are going on in daily life in some places. And we know that they're going on in many places or a number of places in the world in any given decade. We've seen it over and over again. We've seen it in Africa, we've seen it in Latin America, we've seen it in Asia. And we have to ask ourselves how that happens. What gets that to happen? The other thing we have to ask ourselves, how does that relate to us? How are we connected to that? Are we connected to that? When I was in my early years, really in graduate school, I became very much interested in indigenous movements, but I was extremely fortunate or unfortunate, depending on how you want to look at it, that I could do my field work, you might say, under the gun. I was a graduate student in 1972 and 1973, which were some more exciting years in North American Indian history, and got to see paramilitary groups in the United States firsthand. I have to tell you that the Wounded Knee exercise saw two things happen. You saw the national military surround Wounded Knee, and then you saw the paramilitary groups, the Michigan militia, the Alabama militia, it was the Alabama militia and the Michigan, all those militias that were in concert with the U.S. military. They were doing a lot of the shooting in Wounded Knee. They'd come up, crank off a few rounds, run out of bullets, they'd get out of the way, the next militia group would come in, they'd crank off some rounds, so on and so forth. It eventually led to a congressional investigation that changed the laws of the United States to demand that the military be under civilian command and not under paramilitary command, because under such programs that are almost forgotten now, as the cable splicer and garden plot programs, the paramilitary was in connection, in cooperation with the U.S. military. I should say elements of the U.S. military had deep ties to elements of the paramilitary. And back then, it changed the laws. It changed the laws. Congress found out about it. There was a lot of testimony about it. It changed laws. The CIA was told they could no longer do domestic operations. The FBI was told they couldn't do overseas operations. The military was told they can't hold hands anymore with the paramilitary guys. You will remember that paramilitary in the United States was born after the Detroit riots in 1967. The paramilitary in the United States was created for the purpose of doing what they thought the military was too soft-hearted to do. The way they saw it, the guys who hunt raccoons in Alabama said that the National Guard in Michigan was just too soft-hearted to go into Detroit and do what needed to be done, which was to gun down all the people in the inner city in Detroit. So they formed themselves, and they said, next time there's a big riot like that, we'll show up and we'll do it for them. But, of course, in the meantime, the people in Detroit became better armed than the folks in the military and the paramilitary. You notice the paramilitias have never gone in. They never did. They were hoping to find unarmed people to go and shoot, you see. And that's one of the things about the paramilitary. They much prefer unarmed people. You know, armed people are too dangerous. So the paramilitary is not here. The paramilitary is mop-up operation. They want the army to fight with the people with guns. And the paramilitary is to come along and shoot the women and children and old people. That's why they're running around the backwoods of Michigan right now, practicing on weekends, just in case they ever get a chance to shoot some armed people. But this paramilitary exists, its model exists throughout the Americas, and of course we've seen it. It takes place in a number of ways, although in the United States it's the goofiest, actually, of any of them. I mean, these are sort of weekend clubs to run around in fatigues and fire off bullets. In Latin America, it's a lot more serious than that. Quite often, it's military people on off hours or police on off hours, organized and supported by and protected by the government. So One thing we have to continue to demand, and it's a legitimate demand, and it's a reachable demand, and it's one that can, the world community will get behind this demand, and we need to be supportive of that demand forever. Whenever there are actions by what we're calling paramilitary, those people who do those actions, we must demand that the governments of those states arrest those people, and they must also arrest all the people who were connected to them, no matter how high up in government that goes. That's a demand that is achievable immediately, achievable. Even Mexico will accede to that kind of a demand, as long as they arrest the people who do the murders and charge them with the murders. There's a likelihood that there won't be an expansion of that, and it won't turn into the kinds of bloodbaths we've seen in other places where, as you know, in Eastern Europe, they don't arrest them. They let them go wild. And the wilder they go, the more people get hurt. The other piece I wanted to address, though, had to do with our participation in it. And here I'm going to wander for a moment into the contradictions of the world that we live in and why the world that we live in sometimes is so difficult for us to get a grip on where we stand and what we want to do about things. I started my thinking, studying, trying to understand the thinking of the different cultures that I was engaging. And of course, that meant I had to kind of get a handle on the Iroquois culture, and I wanted to get a handle on the Western culture, and I wanted to understand what was the primary difference in the way they thought about things. And I have to say that there's a wildly fraught theory around, and the theory has it that all the knowledge in the world finds its way into academia, and therefore whatever it is that's been thought of somewhere, if some anthropologist someplace writes it down, it becomes common property and everybody has a handle on it. It becomes part of the common knowledge. But I don't believe that that's the case at all. Among the Iroquois, there was a philosopher. And the philosopher among the Iroquois asked a very, very interesting question. And his question, well, what he said essentially was that the culture of violence in which he found himself living, he said, was unacceptable. He wanted to change that culture. And so he said that the way that the culture needed to be changed was that we needed to change the minds of people such that violence was no longer an acceptable way to achieve an end. That the way to achieve an end had to be through understanding what it was that motivated people to do what they did, and then addressing the issues that created that situation, and creating what he described of as a condition of peace. And he thought that peace was not merely the absence of conflict, it was also something that was striven for. It was a socially constructed thing that required a complex set of negotiations among people who had competitions even for resources or whatever it was. Now, if I go back into Western culture, Western civilization, I have to say two things right away about it that's not part of the common wheel in the foundation of Western philosophy. One of them is a very simple thing everybody can understand right away, and that is that organized armed aggression is always taken for the purpose of the acquisition of plunder. Organized armed aggression doesn't happen as a result of somebody's idea of recreation. Underneath it all is a claim by some group or another to the material wealth that is available. So it might not be that they're coming to steal your gold. It might be that they're coming to steal your labor. It might not be that the purpose is the acquisition of land. It might be that what they're looking for is the acquisition of natural resources. But whatever it is, there are no armed forces in the world that are not in the field for the purpose of defending somebody's right to asserted right to loot in some form or another. So let us not ever aggrandize military violence. Military violence is for plunder. That's all it's for. We only have to understand who's plundering who, how and why. That's all we need to know, really. Secondly, I would propose to you this, even the people who are here who have studied Western philosophy. Western philosophy never did ask the question, really, in any serious context, about how do we create peace in the world? Is that an objective? What Western philosophy has asked is a whole different question. It's been going on now since the 1720s. And the question has been, essentially, that there's a vision that we are embarked on a project to create an ever increasingly better world. That the increasingly better world that we're creating is to be done through the acquisition of technology and through economic growth. And at one point it was called the growth of nations. But the word, the key word that describes this project, which will solve, according to this theory, all of humankind's problems, this project we call progress. This project of progress has brought so many things that many of us have benefited from, and we're in favor of those things. But it's not the actual technologies, it's not the actual even economy that I want to point your attention to. It's to the idea that underlies it, that this project is going to solve all of our problems, and that we have permission to do whatever has to be done in order to advance that project. We can do anything to advance that project. That project will bring us cures to cancer. It will bring us untold wealth. It will bring us all the things that are promised to you in all the utopian ideologies that accumulated in the West, many of which are in the canon of texts of Western philosophy studied in this very university. The core thinking of the West aims at that. There's a problem with it. We are also told that we have a whole bunch of human values, that our human values are calculated in terms of family values, of how we honor our ancestors, how we honor our extended families, our parents, our children, how we are human beings in the warmest, gentlest, and most complex way that human beings can be human beings. We're told that that's our values. But when we look around the world, we will find something kind of interesting. Around the world exist traditional cultures in Asia, traditional cultures in Africa, traditional cultures in Latin America. And those traditional cultures do have family values. They do have extended families. They do have connections to the land and to the ecology of the land. They do have connections to their ancestors and to place and time. They do have all of those things. But modernity doesn't have those things. Modernity has a contradiction. In modern life, It makes more sense for those of us who live in cities to have fewer children than have more children, because children are expensive. You can't afford to have a lot of children. So our world has become increasingly individualized. It is much more the product of thinking like John Locke's about the power of possessive individualism than it is about commonality, about the common good, about our species at all. We think more about that which is connected to us, close to us. I point this out because a way to understand what's happening is that the societies that we are looking at are being under pressure by the societies that we live in. The society we live in believes that big is good, large is good. It believes that there's an economy of scale. It believes in this like it believes in a religion. It thinks that large corporations are more efficient than small companies. It thinks that the United States has vital interests in the natural resources of people in other countries and an interest in maintaining the poverty of the people who live in those countries. It believes this to the point that it calls it its national interest. The United States has a huge, huge investment in arming third world countries, not because they're going to be attacked by other third world countries, but because they're maintaining a level of misery at those countries that causes a certain amount of violence. So we're arming them to make sure they win any contest of violence. And not only that, but I have to propose to you that the idea of low intensity warfare wasn't accidentally invented by a banker. It's no accident that was invented by a banker. The banks are in the business of trying to find ways to make money out of these international compacts and agreements. Now that leaves us with a problem. It leaves us with a big problem. And the big problem is, do we like the idea that the International Monetary Fund's basic advice about how a third world country can keep itself floating, in other words, how it can keep its credit rating high enough so the elites there can buy spare parts from the Mercedes-Benz company to keep their cars running. Do we like the idea that the way that that's done is that the IMF gives them a group of policies to do, which essentially deny them the right to subsidize food? Deny, in other words, basically drive the price of food up And the theory of that is it drives the price of labor down, and when you drive the price of labor down, you get investment, right? Invest, because it's about capital chasing cheap labor. And so theoretically, then the capital will come there with cheap labor, and they'll invest in your country, and your problem is solved. Your problem is solved, but people are starving. In the world today, 40,000 people die every single day from preventable causes of poverty. 40,000, mostly children, die every day from diseases, preventable diseases, like diarrhea and hunger itself, or hunger-related diseases. I personally think that we should all sit here for a minute and figure that out. 40,000 a day, how many is that an hour? How many is that a week? How many is that a month? Do you realize that this is a Holocaust on the scale of anything that's happened in the history of the world? That if you're claiming that some large percentage of those 40,000 people who die a day are dying from preventable causes, preventable meaning that we have the means to prevent them. There's enough food in the world to feed them. There's just not enough money spread around enough people so that all those people got money to buy the food, right? This is what we're looking at. I mean, when we get to a Chiapas, this is what's happening in Chiapas is a visible eruption about how that system works. It's just an example of it. But I want to just propose it to you. The problem is this. Do you believe that in order for us to maintain a level of reasonable comfort in Toronto, that we have to have our world banking establishment put in policies that cause hunger, that will cause the deaths of 40,000 babies a day? Do you believe it's necessary? I mean, let's not even say if it's desirable or moral. Is it really necessary? It's an ideology that's been around for a long time. The ideology is, unless people are hungry, they won't work cheap. But do we have to have policies in place? Is it such a horrible idea to demand of the world that it changes this idea? That it makes sure that people who are living in impoverished countries have enough food to eat? Is that really, I mean, we know we got the food. The problem is we're afraid that if people have food, that they're not going to pay their bills. They're not going to work hard enough, and they're not going to be under enough pressure. That's basically the theory going on. Robert McNamara helped us out with this. He helped us invent this. I just want to say this. I don't believe it. I don't believe you got to do this. I don't see it. It's a fraud. It's the biggest fraud that's been perpetrated for quite a while. It's a huge fraud. I can come with the people in the world who want to celebrate the advances of technology, but I don't see why if the advances of science and technology have to be built on the graves of poor people all over the world. I just don't get it. And it's been going on this way for quite a long time now. I mean, it's been argued to us that the reason that it's okay to take Indian land in the first place, they're not using it. We who have a right to use it would be there. We'd use it and make a wonderful thing out of it. They never made a wonderful thing out of it. They stole it, raped it, wrecked it, and left it. That was basically Western history. I'm trying to propose to you that we need to rethink the whole thing. I mean, I really want to throw it at people. The whole thing needs to be rethought. It's simply built out a bunch of theories that have conclusions which are not supportable, not to mention not moral. And in the end, what's going to happen, as long as this system is in place, there will be Chiapas after Chiapas. There will be Indonesia after Indonesia. Unless we start asking ourselves what's good for the people of the world and not asking ourselves what's good for the few banks of the world, unless we change our thinking and stop coming to the conclusion that we can incite incredible misery here and there and never have to think about what it means, unless this is okay with everybody, then I have to say we should stop and rethink the whole thing. And right at its core, is a question about what is the price of progress? Should the price of progress be the lives of the people who least benefit from it? Should it constantly be this way? It has been this way for a long time. And I'm proposing it was needlessly so then, and it's needlessly so now. I find myself just outraged by it, not only by its immorality, but by its needlessness. You don't have to starve people in order to maintain a policy or a culture that celebrates the arts and sciences. In fact, a culture that celebrates the arts and sciences while starving people is no better than one that does it while committing human sacrifices. It's a human sacrifice out of sight and out of mind until some group of people raise the flag of rebellion. Now, in this particular case, I would like to say, those of you who would like to look into this, the Indians of Chiapas raised the flag of rebellion in one of the classiest ways that it's ever been raised. This was really wonderful. I mean, I have to say some of the best poetry written in this half of the century came right out of there, right out of this rebellion. And some of the most eloquent explanations about what's wrong with the world came right out of there. This is an enlightened rebellion, spoken for the first time that I know of, from the point of view, out of the voice of the people closest to the earth. It is not spoken from the point of view from people, from academics from German universities. It's not spoken from the point of view of people from the Chicago School of Economics, not even from the radical section of the Chicago School of Economics. It's really the voice of people coming from the land. And it's a voice really that we can learn from on the one hand, in a kind of almost, I want to say spiritual, in the sense that the West and these kinds of places we're living in understands that word. Not the way people in other worlds understand it, but the way we understand it, spiritual meaning. It's kind of enlightening and uplifting. It has a kind of moral component, and it has a kind of energetic component at the same time. But I think it's all of those things at once. And I think it's a wonderful place in which to start a lesson thing. But I think it's another thing too. I mean, the students in our universities are like those people on Seinfeld, you know? I mean, they cease to care about, you know, and that's what we're looking at, isn't it? In Chiapas, we're looking at a wreck, and something is wrecked. There's a lot more wrecked, but this is what we can see right now, the spotlight's on it. And it's interesting, there's not enough discussion about what's at the root of that wreck. There's not enough questioning about whether the assumptions that give the institutions that make the decisions about who eats and who doesn't eat, whether those assumptions are right or wrong, and whether those assumptions are moral or immoral, or whether we should stand for them or not. And there's not enough anger. People are not enough energized by this. I suppose they're waiting for it to get closer. They want to see the people starving up close, but actually, you don't have to go very far. You just go to Detroit or something. You can see some of them. There. What is happening in our world is that while we're espousing human values, family values, and so forth, we're also on some level, we're cheering the very movements in the world that are taking those apart, that are deconstructing those things. And most of us want both of them. Most of us want strong family values, and we want to see a world in which progress is made against disease, and a world in which there's technological changes and innovations that make our lives more interesting, and so on and so forth. But I have to ask you why we can't demand all of it. Why we can't demand, on the one hand, that the kind of technology and the kind of economy that we live in enables us to maintain family ties and all of those nice things that we say we'd like to have. And also why it is that we can't live in a world in which no child goes to bed hungry at night, anywhere in the world. And explain to us why it can't be that way. I tell you, I have not seen any reason that it can't be that way. There's no explanation for that. The main reason that it's that way is because people who are in charge of policy have said it has to be that way, and other people who have listened to this haven't questioned it enough. Until we question the very idea that only hunger will create prosperity in the world, unless we deconstruct that idea, unless we just shout it down every time we hear it, unless we draw it to everybody's attention all the time, not a single thing that's happening in Chiapas is going to make a difference. But if we can do that, if we can focus on where the major contradiction is in this way of thinking, and what's wrong with that major contradiction, we might be able to make enough noise at some point or another to make changes. And by noise, I mean we need to make an honest attack at the clearest thinking people who are in charge of those institutions and making those kinds of policies. That doesn't mean that I don't think that in the meantime we can look away from or not understand what we have to do on the immediate level. On the immediate level, what needs to happen in this particular instance is that we need to find ways to make sure the people in Chiapas have enough food to eat. Or at least we have to try to know that we tried to see to it that they did. And for that, I hope people tonight can get some organization behind them and do your little part in that story. Beyond that, though, I think everybody has a bigger thing to do, and that is we have to kind of question how things got to be the way they are, whether they're acceptable the way they are, and what we need to do to change them to make them acceptable. Thank you.
Okay, but there was a request that we clarify the question. As I understood the question, you were asking, how do we change the conservatism of thinking among the people who are at the level of decision making? Is that it? Yeah, I think we need to, for a moment, think about the fact that the culture of Mexico has a different and distinct history from the cultures of Canada and the United States. They're not the same ones. And I'm inclined to say that I have met plenty of people in Mexico who I thought were among the world's greatest intellectuals going. The place is marvelously peopled with enlightened individuals. What I kind of worry about more is how we change the conservative thinking of the people here. And let me, while we're here, let me explain a little bit about what I see to be the problem. We're holding this conference in one of the great research universities in North America. It's not only one of the largest, but it's one of the most diverse ones. The universities at this hour are not really, I mean, they advocate themselves, a lot of them do, advocate themselves as places where one goes to challenge one's mind by engaging the great thoughts of the culture. But in fact, in order to pass, you have to not only engage the thoughts, you have to more or less sign on to the thoughts. Well, one of the problems that we have is that for about 300 years, almost all the thinking has been has been narrowed down to the canon, has been thinking that has been cheered on. It has been made popular. It was popularized among what we think of as the ruling elites in the culture. Now, the ruling elites didn't agree on everything. They had huge disagreements. I mean, a lot of the premises of Marxism, for example, are very, very different, one has to say, from the premises of John Locke, for example. They're miles apart. But what hasn't happened in the academy is the same thing that hasn't happened in the society. People haven't stepped back and asked themselves whether these ideologies, which are promoted to us as philosophies, by the way, were somehow fundamentally carried out in an overly enthusiastic way, or at least a fundamentally flawed way, such that when you look at the United States, which is the place, in my opinion, that we have to look at first, we really need to ask ourselves why our military budget is so high. What's the purpose of that very, very high military budget? Well, it's an ideology in America. America really believe, they say they're planning to be ready. We're not just ready, you know. We're ready. We're not just ready. I mean, you know, like, nobody can attack us, right? Ah, Christ, nobody's even got a military, nobody's got a national budget equal to our military budget. I think that in terms of our trying to understand, we have to go at the primary thinking in the culture. We're going to have to go at it and really question it. And I'm of an opinion that it hasn't been questioned very much. We've kind of gone along with it, and you'll notice this, ever since, ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, there hasn't been a spirited debate in the West anymore. And it's because the theory has it, well, capitalism fell and capitalism prevailed and communism fell. Socialism's old hat and we can't go back and look at that anymore. And the theory here is because this is where all of the world's thinking is at. It's not where all the world's thinking is at, right? It's not. I mean, the world's thinking's got, there's what, 5,000 cultures in the world, and 4,999 of them aren't represented here. What the problem is that we haven't really kind of sorted out what this all means in Chiapas. What does this all mean in the rest of the worlds that are around us? And how can we look at those worlds with new eyes? The way we look at the way we were trained, the way this culture wants to look at those worlds, it wants to look at those worlds more or less as not contemporary worlds. They're not contemporary. The Mayans are not contemporary people. They're living in the same time as us, but not in the same era. They live in a backward world. You've heard this. They don't live in our world. And because they live in a backward world, we don't have to think about them, right? Because they're in a time capsule separated from us. But I have to propose to you that I think in both in time and space, and our ways of thinking about how the world is folds out, that we really need to call on people to rethink things. I don't think that they're justified in putting together policies that cause mass starvation of poor people around the world. But at the same time, I don't think that they're right in thinking and justifying this on the basis of the idea that these are not contemporary peoples. In fact, given their thinking, they're the only contemporary people there are. Unless you're part of this group, you're not part of any contemporary thinking. Therefore, you don't count. You're dismissed. Now, the other piece of it for me, I'm saying this in the sense that we've talked about multiculturalism, we've talked about transculturalism, I've heard all this stuff. Everybody gave lip service during the 80s and 90s to this and that and everything. The reality of it never happened. It never happened. Not in academia, not in politics, not anywhere. It's never really happened. We still think of people in other cultures as living in other times from us. I say those people who are in that. And we need to change that. That's one thing. The other thing is that, since the Soviet Union fell, there's a feeling here that there's a hopelessness, that we don't like what's going on, but we don't have any theory to operate from. And that's partly because we're assuming that the theories that we're going to operate from come out of the same sources that we looked at before. And people are kind of looking at the same sources. I want to propose to you, reality is a good source. There's nothing wrong with reality as a source for coming up with a theory about how the world works. And there's nothing wrong with understanding other people's situations within those realities. In other words, by and large, we have not opened ourselves up to enough sympathy and understanding about how the world is in Chiapas, or how the world is in perhaps in rural Indonesia, or how the world is in other places. We haven't made that jump to try to sort that part out yet. And I think we're gonna need to do that. Now, how do you get the people in power to do that? The people in power are assuming that they have the capacity to ignore these things. They're actually shaken by that in this last year. They're shaken by it because they thought they don't have to worry about the Asian crisis either. They thought to get their attention, what they've been assuming is that they can control all the events over all the world. They believe they can do it. And they have a theory about how they're going to do it. And the theory has to do with the free market economy. And right now, everything in the world is geared to that. And I think their belief is that whatever it is that happens in the world in Asia doesn't matter to them. We're really going to have to find ways to get their attention to change that belief. Because and I have to say this, ever since Friedman came along, he has been completely, I mean, I don't know if people here are clear about how ideologically driven policy making is in the West right now and how it is in the United States. But the theory is that the markets drive everything. It's almost like as if human beings have no control over that at all. And so what they're basically saying is if you don't do A or B or C or D, automatically things happen that harm you. But they're doing all those things, and those things are being harmed anyway. I'm very much of this opinion for both the nation state of Mexico and for the Mayas. And that is that I don't know what's best for them. They have to know what's best for themselves. And I'm dodging that because my experience with Westerners is that we always know what's best for everybody else. And I'm not gonna do it. They have to, they have intelligent, brilliant people there that we can ally ourselves with, and they can organize the energy that they'd like to get from us, and we would do that. And some of that energy, by the way, has to do with activism, because activism shines light in dark corners, but some of it has to do with other things. Some of the activism I think needs to happen on a much greater scale than it is happening, but it is happening, has to do with us making priorities of supporting people in rural areas, small farms, small growers, small things in rural areas. The kind of connections you're talking about, I think are very, very substantially important. I think they're way more important. Everybody up here thinks that's goody-two-shoes stuff. It's not goody-two-shoes stuff. You should be supporting those small growers here in Ontario too. But, The center piece of motivation for the world economy as seen by the people who are making decisions has to do with who's got the lever on how to increase or decrease hunger. And I don't think you want to get away from that. If community action people get a handle on that lever, they can change that quite a bit. It's not like as if we couldn't change that at all. That's the, one of the reasons why I think agricultural policy is the key to things. Not agribusiness policy, but agricultural policy. But I think it's very important for us to A, have our ears to listen to the people who are in the designated place over there tell us what it is they need from us. I think it's very important that instead of us going there telling them what they need to do. But I think beyond that, the much more important question for me is always, what is it that we should be doing among ourselves? Because in effect, the sickness that we see in Mexican society or Indonesian society, Filipino society, all the societies are looking over there and saying, oh my God, look at that horrible thing over there. That woman that went outside is right. That's here too. It's growing here too. It's a big problem here too. If we're not careful, one generation from now, the number of street people will increase by 20% or 30%. We need to have control over things over here too. So it's the decision makers on the one hand who are in the high corporations on the one hand, but each and every one of us in here is a decision maker on some level. Each and every one of us decides where our dollars are going to go and what they're going to do and so on and so forth. And every one of us has some capacity to act in the circle in which we work and act. But I propose the main thing I wanted people to do is among other things, I want you to do. I got a big long list, but we got a short night. But the big thing I really want people to do in this context, and having a meeting like this, talking about an issue like this, is I want people to question the thinking that got us to this place. I want you to interrogate that from what you already know about the world that you're living in, and I want you to ask your friends to interrogate it too. I think that it's not necessary to kill 40,000 little kids a day in order to maintain the world economy. I think that Robert McNamara was the devil himself. I think that this is just a terrible, terrible situation. I don't think we should put up with it. I think we should moan and complain about it all the time and share it with our friends at the poker game or wherever we are. I think we need to change it in a way in which we start to have some energy and some confidence that we're starting to understand how the world really works and what we're going to need to do to change it. But we're going to have to talk with one another for quite a while to kind of figure out all the little ways that we can change it. I want people to work on the ideology first. I don't know if it's ideology, actually, it's thinking. I actually don't have an ideology. In fact, I'm against ideology.